So I try. That's one thing I always keep my mind on. Like never overpower the original flavor with some other components. Same thing goes with tare and oil, like and the amount of oil too. Because if you put too much like garlic, aromatics, whatever in the oil, and if you put too much of that in the bowl of ramen you're making, you're just destroying the whole flavor and the effort you put into the broth.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Way of Ramen podcast. In today's episode, I sit down with Peisan, a ramen chef working in the DC area. Peisan has an interesting story in the sense that he was born and he grew up in Japan, but he's not Japanese. His parents moved to Japan from Myanmar and worked in the culinary world. His dad actually made ramen at his job in Japan. And after moving to the US as a teenager, he went on to attend the Culinary Institute of America, where he met a friend who was also from Japan and also had deep ties to the ramen world. And since then, Peisan has been making ramen at work and making ramen at home and just basically fully invested in making ramen and getting better at it. Peisan has a very thoughtful approach to making ramen, and I'm always excited to talk to younger chefs who seem to have figured out a lot of these things that I, myself, am only figuring out now. Not just in terms of techniques and things, but just the philosophy behind making food for other people. So I really enjoyed my conversation with Peisan, and I think you will too. All right, let's get right into it. So thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
No, thank you. No, I appreciate it too.
Okay, so could you start off by introducing yourself to everybody? I'm not sure if a lot of people know who you are, but...
Yeah, I know. I just recently got connected with all the ramen people on Instagram.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Past like a month, I guess. Yeah, I popped up out of nowhere, so... So my name is Peisan. I live in Maryland. I work at the ramen restaurant called Chaplin's in DC. I'm a sous chef there. I grew up in Tokyo, and I moved to the United States when I was 15. And then I've been working at the ramen restaurant I work right now for the past 6 years. But like, wow. It only has been like 2 years since I started making my own ramen.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. That's about it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that you grew up in Japan. So were you born in Japan too?
Yeah, I was born in Japan too.
Oh, wow. Wow. And did you go through like international school, or did you go to like a standard Japanese school with Japanese kids and stuff?
I went to Japanese kindergarten, but then from elementary through halfway through middle school, I was in international school in Japan.
Ah, I see. I see.
Yeah.
And how would you, but your Japanese level is really high. I've seen, you know.
It's my first language, actually, but my parents are from Burma, also known as Myanmar. So I do treat Japan as my mother country, and then it's my mother language as well. But since I don't have any like Japanese genes, like, I'm physically not Japanese, but like Japan, I say Japan is my mother country.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I'm not Hawaiian, but I grew up in Hawaii, so I get it. Yeah, man. So your parents were like in Japan for work or something? Like,
They moved when they were in their mid-20s, and then that's when I was born. And then they ended up in Japan for almost 25 years, I'd say.
Oh, wow. And they're still in Japan now, or are they?
No, they're with me. I live with my parents right now.
Oh, I see. So they all moved to the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were in Burma, or what is it, Burma or Myanmar? Which is the correct one?
So like Burma is like the like original, like old school name for Burma, like the country, like old people, not old people, but like the, I said like in their people from their 40s, 50s, 60s and so on, they call it Burma. But then the new generation, the youth generation, they call it Myanmar.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So your parents, they were in Myanmar, and then they moved to Japan, and then from Japan they moved to the U.S.
Right.
Oh, that's crazy.
It really is.
Yeah. So that was kind of one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the show, is because, you know, you grew up in Japan and you're not Japanese. And
Japanese, yeah, right.
All that kind of stuff. But your English is really good too. So I was kind of, I was kind of like interested to see like, you know, what is his English going to sound like when I get him on the show? Because Burmese guy from... grew up in Japan, living in the U.S. now.
I don't know, it's really common. People usually ask me like what are you, like where are you from, and I actually do not have a answer for that. Like I don't even know who I am. Like You tell me where I'm from. I don't know.
Yeah. I see a lot of that. It's just real interesting because Japan is such like a, there's only like Japanese people there pretty much. And there's like, if you're like not Japanese, you kind of do stand out growing up there, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's crazy. So did you eat a lot of ramen when you were growing up in Japan? Like,
yes, actually, my father, he used to work at this, like a shokudo, like a diner style Japanese restaurant called Zao. It was, they used to have like 15 locations inside Tokyo, but now it's down to 3. But he used to work there for like 20 plus years. So oh, wow. That's where I got my ramen jeans from, honestly.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. Cool, man. So I also saw that you went to CIA on your profile.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
So that's kind of like, there's a couple of reasons that I want to get you on. One is like, okay, let's hear what this guy's English sounds like, because it's kind of interesting story. The second one was, you know, I saw you went to CIA. So could you tell me about that, or tell us about that a little bit? And
like how I got into CIA?
Yeah. How you got in there, and then like what you learned, and are you applying any of that to your ramen making process today? Or?
Okay. Yeah, cool. So like how I actually got into CIA was before I got into cooking, I actually wanted to do like music as my career. Mm-hmm. So like I tried, you know, I wanted my major to be audio engineering, like mixing and all those. That's my like original goal. But then I applied for like so many universities and they all rejected me. And then I was like, what am I going to do? And then I talked it out to my mom. And my mom was like, you know what? Like, honestly, I don't see you as a musician in the future. Why don't you, like, you're already like more than half step into the restaurant industry. Why don't you like go to this school? It's well known. It was one of her like dream school. And she told me it was CIA, which I didn't know of at all. And then I just Googled CIA application. Okay, $50, boom, applied. And then I got accepted. And I was like, okay, well, okay. I got into a college. And I looked it up, and it was known as Harvard of Culinary Industry. And I'm like, okay, wow, well, okay.
Yeah,
I gotta keep my game up. And then I did have like passion for cooking since I was in high school. That's where I started cooking. So like when I got into CIA, when I went through all the basic culinary like skill stuff, and I was like, okay, maybe this is what I actually want to do. But then back then I still thought, okay, maybe I want to do French in future, Italian, I don't know. And then while building up my culinary skills, I met this Japanese kid. He was at the CIA as well. And then his father owns like one of the biggest ramen chain in the world. Like if I say it, I don't think I'm allowed to like
say
the name, but like if I do say so, everybody knows that place. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay, this kid is like interesting. And then he actually was, I say he's the biggest inspiration to me, because we grew up in like a really similar environment. Like he had a father who's a ramen chef, and I had a father who's a ramen chef, and then we were talking about ramen, and then his actions made me want to make my own ramen during like over the weekend, even out of school. And then I started making, and the more I make my own ramen, I actually got into it, because until then all I did was follow my father's recipe at work. Like, you know, I made the tare, I followed the recipe for work, but I never made my original ramen. Mm-hmm. And I started applying a lot of like cooking techniques I learned at school, and then that's how I started making ramen.
What year was that?
I graduated last September, so yeah, it's really recent. It's really, really recent. I started CIA at 2018. I started making my own ramen at May of 2018.
Oh, that's pretty cool, man. Like, so
thank you.
And how old are you, by the way?
I'm 24 right now.
Oh yeah, you're a little baby. You're so young. Okay, cool. So okay, so you started making your own ramen from what you learned at CIA. Mm-hmm. I also saw that you were, when you first started making ramen, okay, so I'm going to get to this other question first, but when you first started making ramen, where did you look to first? Did you try to find like Japanese resources to figure out the basics, or did you like just talk to your dad, or like how did you get started in that process?
So like thing about me is I'm not a huge fan of following what people do. Mm-hmm. So like I'm not a huge fan. I don't really like doing what exactly my father does as well. So like when I first started making ramen, the very first bowl I made was like shoyu chintan, like classic shoyu ramen. Mm-hmm. And then instead of following my father's recipe, I was like, okay, what do I actually want into this bowl? So like I made a few arrangements to the taro recipe my father had. And that's how I started. So like I never really do look up for recipes, and I just like think through what I want in this bowl first, and then I just make some arrangements, add stuff, like take some stuff out. What oil do I want? What kind of broth do I want? What kind of like add-ons, what do I want? And that's how I'm still practicing. Like that's how I brainstorm in my head first and then apply it. And then I eat it. And if I did it work well, of course, I just like, you know, take a note, what went wrong, what went right, stuff like that. And I just repeat that over and over.
Yeah, that sounds very like Kanda-san-esque philosophy mm-hmm, to that.
Right.
As far as like knowing like what kind of flavors and ingredients, did you pick that up mm-hmm. just working with your dad, or did you pick that up at CIA? Because, you know, like if you're just starting mm-hmm. to learn how to make ramen and you don't really have much of a culinary background,
right
like how do you discover those things?
So think about me, I really feel blessed about this, but growing the fact that I grew up in Japan and the fact that I grew up like having parents as chefs. My mother is also a chef, but like in a different genre. Huh. So like I grew up eating good food. Like I was in Japan too. So like I don't mean to brag about this, but like I think myself as like a really good taster. Uh-huh. So I just like, that's how I get all the, just how I figure all the layers of flavor. And then, yeah, I just like think of good, for example, I imagine a good bowl of ramen I had before, and mm-hmm. then think through why I thought that was good, and then like refine it in my own words, own techniques, like stuff like that. And then I make it, if it's bad, I fix it, repeat it over and over.
And how long do you stick to something? Like, so say you make something, mm-hmm. you have this image in your brain, you make it, doesn't come out like how you thought it was going to come out. Like how long mm-hmm. do you stick with that bowl? Do you keep trying to make it till it tastes what you want it to taste like?
Yeah. Not like 3 years, like how the sun does it. But yeah. That's extreme, but like in a good way. I don't do that, but like, I do stick to it until I get satisfied with what mm-hmm. I make.
And that's pretty
months. Yeah, months. It takes months. Like for noodles too, I do make noodles on my own on mm-hmm. my day offs, but I still haven't reached my goal or satisfaction yet. So like when it comes to noodles, like I recalculate the cooking time, ratios, water, humidity in the room, temperature, stuff like that. Wow. Yeah, I do stick with it, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I was kind of blown away, like when I was talking to him, you know, I didn't really know who he was, but Backyard Ramen mm-hmm. just kept talking about him, like, oh, he's the man. And it's like, okay, let's try mm-hmm. to get him on the show. And I noticed that you were in his group when, you know, the interview came up, and it's like, oh, like I was talking to this guy on Instagram.
Oh, I see that guy. Yeah.
So how did you find out about him, or like, you know?
Remember the kid I said earlier who I met at CIA?
Yeah, yeah.
He was in it, and he was like, hey, like, go for it. Like, there's like so many Japanese like cool old men's in a group, like 2,000 people. They just share their own recipe, and then they just share. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I'll join. Uh-huh. And then I started joining, and I see people like showing their own recipes, techniques, what they do. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I want to be one of these guys.
Yeah, it's really, kind of crazy.
I found it like, really cool, yeah.
Yeah, when so Backyard Ramen said, like, oh, he has this group. So I went, applied, and got in. Mm-hmm. And just reading through the posts, it's like, oh my gosh, man, like this is... This is kind of one of the
they do is like experts, like they know what they're doing, but like they're not a ramen chef, like it's not their own like real job.
Yeah,
they're just like a regular like businessman in their work time, and that's all they like in their private time. They make ramen, which is like a lot better than what you can eat in America.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It really is crazy.
So that's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about, as far as, because when I saw you there, it's like, oh, this is going to be cool, because we can talk about, like, what are the differences between, like, people that are making ramen at home in Japan, mm-hmm. and people that are making ramen at home in America? Because I know, like, just if you go generally, like, there, people are younger in America that are trying to make ramen at home. Right. And in Japan, it seems to be more, you know, like, middle-aged men, mm-hmm. salary men, mm-hmm. and so what do you see as far as, like, differences in, like, the people, and as far as, like, the skill level and knowledge of making ramen between, like, the home ramen cook here and the home ramen cook there?
That really is a hard question. I guess home cooking ramen over there in Japan, in their mid-aged old, like, males, it's just my opinion, but, like, from what I think, Japanese men, when they enter, like, certain ages, they start making, like, noodles. I don't know if that's, like, the right thing, but it's like how grandma starts gardening, like, out of nowhere.
Yeah,
I think it's, like, the same feeling, you know, like, but, you know, like, when grandma walks on a street and they see a, like, really pretty flower, they'll be like, oh, hey, that's a pretty flower. And then I think just, like, Japanese men do the same thing when they see a ramen shop, be like, oh, that sounds cool, let me do it too. I think it's, like, a really similar sensations, and they just, like, get really into it.
And
they really get good at it too. But, like, the ramen chefs, home cooked chefs in America, like, around my age especially, mm-hmm. they're really passionate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it's interesting because I grew up in Japan, and for me, it's like a natural thing to happen. I say, like, I like food, I like ramen. For me, it's, like, a natural thing. But, like, people out here, they're not Japanese, but then mm-hmm. they somehow get to know the culture about ramen, and they get really passionate about it. And then they make, I've never tasted one before, but, like, just by looking at the pictures, like, it's really, really authentic.
Yeah, yeah.
And creative too. It's really impressive.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. Like, I never thought about it, but I guess there's not as much space in Japan. So, like, a lot of Americans, when they get to, like, middle age, they take up, like, woodworking or things like that. It's kind of like, well, you can't go build a desk, but you can make noodles at home, I guess, in a small, like, 2LDK or something.
Plus, in Japan, you don't really have to make one, even though, like, you do like ramen. You can go to, like, ramen shops are everywhere in Japan, mm-hmm. but in US, it's, like, it's really limited.
Yeah,
like, the good ramen restaurants are really limited, like, really, really limited. Like, you see few in California, few in New York, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, people like Ramen Lord, I forgot his last name, but Mike.
Yeah.
Ramen Addict Hung from DC, and, like, all the ramen chefs in California, New York. Like, they know what they're doing. Like, their passion is really, really out there, and it's really impressive seeing that.
Yeah. Like, Mike is insane. Insane. Yeah. Like, he jumps into the Discord. I want to make it, like, a weekly thing, like, where Mike just talks on Mondays, and, like, he will jump into voice chat and he'll just, like, talk mm-hmm. for, like, an hour about the differences about making noodles and things.
It's
like
really,
that.
So really, really impressive.
He's really knowledgeable. So it's kind of really crazy. Is. And it's like, crazy too, because, you know, he's not like someone like you who grew up in Japan and these things. Mm-hmm. Like, he went there for college, for study abroad, and fell in love with ramen, came back and learned all this on his own in Chicago, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's crazy. I kind of want to go back to, like, the tasting. Mm-hmm. So you're a musician too. Like, I was a musician in my past life. Okay. So I kind of find it, like, interesting where maybe there's a parallel of, like, as a musician, you can listen to a track and you mm-hmm. can break down, like, okay, this is the bass line is doing this, and then the mm-hmm. drum is doing this, the hi-hat of the drum is doing this, mm-hmm. lead guitar is doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of similar, like, when I heard you talk about, like, how you can taste the flavors in a bowl. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's any kind of overlap between...
Okay, now you mentioned it, it does... Okay, now I see a few connections to it. Mm-hmm. And then... In the past, there was one time I was talking to this bartender in DC, and then he asked me what my passion is, what's my favorite kind of food to make, and I said ramen. He said, okay, like, why is that? And then we were talking it out, and then we figured that we do the same thing too. Like bartenders, they build up layers in one shot of like alcohol or spirits, like like cocktails or whatever. And I do the same thing too. And then when you just mentioned about music, it did give a little click in my mind. It really is similar.
Yeah, because like if you don't make music, you don't know that you're tracking out like the track, you know, mm-hmm. like 20 tracks for one song, you know, and 30 tracks, and you're like every single little thing has mm-hmm. to be its own kind of thing.
Right. And they got to balance out to make it sound good
too. Yeah. Like it's, and it's not just like one of the track, every single track in that song has to be perfect or near mm-hmm. perfect, because you can't just like, you know,
right.
So you just keep doing it over and over again. So I was kind of like, when you were saying that, I was like, oh, that is kind of like, if you're a musician, that makes sense that you could maybe that kind of like, there's an overlap there as far as like a mm-hmm. skill set of being able to have that kind of like level of attention to these details maybe someone who doesn't have that background wouldn't even think. So you have like the musical background and like the culinary background, and you're kind of using that together.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of nuts.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's really cool.
Cool.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up.
I kind of, you know, because I never thought about it either. Like I've spent time in studios and stuff, and it's
okay.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So, have as far as like from when you first started making ramen to now, I guess, and you probably mm-hmm. don't think you're finished with your experimentation and journey.
Yeah,
yet,
not at all. Not at
have
all.
You? Yeah. Can you do like any big breakthroughs come to mind? Like when you think about like your process of making ramen over the past 2 years, like, is there anything that stands out? Like, oh man, when I figured this thing out, like that really like leveled up my game or.
Adding fat to the bowl of ramen was the first thing I figured. The very first shoyu ramen I made, it was really clean, but now I think of it, there wasn't any fat in there. It tasted really bland. Like, the aroma is there, the noodle structure is all right, but then I was like, there's something big like missing. And then my friend gave me a book, like a ramen book, and I was reading through, and then I figured how huge impact fat gives to a bowl of ramen. And I started adding, like, I made aroma oil, put it in, and it tasted like so much better, even though everything else was exact the same. And that's how I started, like, arrangement to the tadesh, arrangement to the oil, different noodles, different toppings. What else? But like stuff like that.
Yeah, that's kind of like I see a lot of like, not a lot, but when you watch some like of these ramen videos on YouTube where, mm-hmm. you know, there's like people that have cooking channels that they make lots of different mm-hmm. things, and then they'll do like a ramen and they almost always forget any kind of aroma oil or something like that. And so it is kind of like interesting because people don't think about, I guess if you're not someone who makes ramen a lot,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to think about, oh, I got to put some kind of oil in here or fat in here to kind of make it taste real.
To like non-ramen people, like people who don't know much about ramen, they usually do misunderstand by adding fat. It just makes it unhealthy or like adding some, for them, I think it feels more like adding grease to a dish.
Uh-huh.
But like, the truth behind it is it balances the whole, every components in the ramen bowl. Like the fat is like the big guy who just supports everything.
Yeah. It's like, it's so important because, and it's kind of weird. Cause if you think about it, I guess there really isn't many like Western style soups that you mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, let's just throw a bunch of lard in there.
you know, there's like, no way you could do it. No.
Yeah. You try to like, and so even like, I think the first time I made ramen for my family, like I had my, mm-hmm. it was kind of like a big thing and I just was starting to learn, but I knew that, okay, I got to put some kind of chicken oil, or chicken fat in mm-hmm. here or something. And then my uncle's like, oh, that's so gross. Like, why would you do that? But that's kind of like, he's like, when I make ramen, I take all the fat out. I was like, oh,
no.
But it's kind of like
that's a big no.
It's kind of like the general misconception, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Are there any like, as far as making ramen, have you discovered mm-hmm. like any general rules of thumb for making like soups or noodles or anything? Or like, you know, like mm-hmm. some people say you have to just simmer it for like, if you want to make a chintan, I'll give you an example of mm-hmm. like a general rule of thumb that I've heard. if you want to make a chintan, you simmer it for 6 hours at like 176 or something like that, you know. Do you have any kind of like of these things that you've discovered on your own?
No, not really. Like, think about me is I never measure. I don't know how much I'm making. I don't know how many pounds of bones I have. Uh-huh. I don't know how much water I'm adding, but I just like, I cook by following my feeling sensations. That's it. Uh-huh. But like that, like making like chicken chintan, 6-7 hours for on 170 degrees. That sounds right. And that's probably what I'm doing, but like I'm doing it like, how to say, what's the word for it, but not knowing that I'm doing.
Yeah. Just like improvising.
Then, yeah. And for like, tonkotsu, chicken paitan, toti paitan, stuff like that, I just like boil it, like hard boil it for hours.
Yeah.
Clean the bones, hard boil it. And pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. And how's your, like, has the results without doing, I know Hung does the same thing, like Ramen Addict. He doesn't measure anything either.
Yeah.
But as far as like the results, like, are you finding that even without measuring or measuring temperatures or bones or water, you're able to produce similar tasting bowls? Like if you make a chicken chintan 3 months ago and then make one today.
Yeah, I can.
Wow. That's pretty cool, man.
Thank you.
And you're adjusting. So like, how are you doing it? Are you tasting, adjusting at the same time? Or is it like the tare and oil bring so much? Because, you know, you can have tare that sits around for pretty much forever.
Forever, yeah.
Yeah. And so do you think that's it? Or is it kind of like just the adjustments on the fly? You can kind of make it. I've seen like videos of Taishoken, Yamagishi. Like he's just tasting like, oh, putting more carrots and stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess if you get to that level, you could do that. But I'm not there yet.
Yeah, I'm not there yet either, but I do that.
That's kind of the big takeaway that I got from talking to Kanda-san was the building your knowledge base to a level where you can feel confident in knowing what's missing and what's not missing, rather than relying on other people to tell you what's there and what's not there. Like, how do you develop that? Is it just through massive tasting and analyzing and trying to concentrate?
Tasting for sure. Like when I make ramen, when I say, okay, tomorrow's my day out, I'm gonna do a cook testing, tasting ramen. And then I go through, at least go through 3-4 bowls of ramen, like one single type of ramen. I eat the first bowl. If it's bad, I make a few, but like, let's just say I make the first bowl and I didn't like it, but I finished that bowl anyways too. So that I can make like an actual comment to that bowl. Like I'm a person who can't make enough comments by first bite. So I always try to finish like the whole bowl.
Yeah.
And then think what I felt after eating the bowl. I always think what I feel on the first bite and what I feel at the very last sip of the broth. And then think back through what I felt during the whole eating time. And then that's how I adjust the saltiness of the tare, ratio of the tare and the broth, hardness of the noodle, cooking time of the noodle, ratio of the noodle. And I make another bowl and adjust the cooking, tare, everything, eat it again. And if I'm not satisfied, I make a third bowl. And then I split that third bowl with my parents most of the time and see what they think. And just repeat that over and over.
Yeah. How do you, as far as like tare, so like when I was talking to Kanda-san, he says, just use shoyu for your tare if you're going to make shoyu ramen, or just use the base ingredient and work on pumping things into the soup.
Does he use like just pure shoyu, like soy sauce? That's it?
Yeah, that's what he said. He says for his, on the podcast, that's what he said. He said like, he said like he just, because it's like there's a big difference between making ramen at a restaurant or making it at home. He says a lot of times restaurants will load up the tare with umami because you're trying to compensate for what is the English word for that? Bureru. the changes in the flavor when it kind of breaks, I guess. I don't know how to explain
consistency?
That. Yeah, the know. Consistency. Like, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so he says you're compensating for the inconsistencies of the soup by packing the tare with umami. And so you can have like a tare, you can make a massive batch of tare and that will last you for a long time. And the tata you're strict on as far as like, you know, the quantities and measurements and stuff.
Right.
And then the soup, because the quality of the bones changes, what types of bones you can get, what type, the quality of the vegetables, aromatics that you put in, that is not as consistent. So you compensate with it by having a very consistent tare that flavors it. And so he says, but if you're doing it at home, you can just choose to instead pack all of that into the soup and use a cut the tare down to its bare elements and then use that to just flavor, give it the flavor of that stuff. So I don't know. What did you think about that? I thought that was pretty fascinating. So I kind of wanted to know if that's what you do too, but it sounds like you're doing more of like the traditional ramen restaurant approach to tare.
More like a restaurant. Cause I that's what I used to, cause I work in a ramen restaurant. So like the tare, I do put a lot of stuff in my tare to boost the umami up. But that still doesn't mean I don't put much power, like much effort on the broth. But I do like give my attention to the broth, like cooking time, water ratio and everything. I try to as much as possible like supporting components, ingredients to my tare and the broth, but like not to the point it breaks the original flavor. Like let's just say when you're making like chicken chintan or something, some people do add like aroma, like aromatics, like maripa, onions, carrot and stuff, and ginger, garlic. I do too, but like I don't want to overpower, especially when it comes to like ginger, garlic.
Yeah, ginger, man,
I don't like putting them too much, because it just overpowers the original protein or original base of the stock, even sauces, like whatever. So I try, that's one thing I always keep my mind on. Like never overpower the original flavor with some other components. Same thing goes with tare and oil, like and the amount of oil too. Because if you put too much like garlic, aromatics, whatever in the oil, and if you put too much of that in the bowl of ramen you're making, you're just destroying the whole flavor and the effort you put into the broth.
That's a pretty good general rule. Like never overpower your main ingredients with things. Ginger is like my thing that I always mess up on. Like I always end up putting I do it way too often where I put too much ginger. And then when I taste it, it's like, man, this is just ginger soup. I might as well just boil ginger and just drink the ginger. You know?
It's a different story when it comes to like Niigata style shoyu ramen, because like they're known for shoga shoyu. So like when it comes to that, ginger gotta stand up. But like if you're doing like tonkotsu, like something you wanna like you want to enhance the pork flavor, and then you put too much ginger or aromatics, it's like, I don't know, like instant noodle with ginger powder.
Yeah.
That's how it tastes like.
Yeah, ginger's a tricky one. I feel like it's kind of like the balancing that one for me, it's been the hardest thing, because I want a little bit of it in there, but I don't, but it always ends up being just too much sometimes when I'm not careful. Yeah. Like, what's your favorite style of ramen to just eat? And
man, that's a hard question. I knew someone would ask me this today. I did think it through, but like I like everything, but like I guess something more asari, like Tokyo style shoyu ramen will be my number one go-to.
Yeah, man, that's good stuff. Do you, in America, it really does seem, it's still like, it's kind of changing, you know, you see some people doing cool things now, but it still is tonkotsu heavy. Like I kind of wonder, bold. Yeah. I kind of wonder if that style will kind of come into popularity soon, because if you talk to Japanese people, they'll say like, well, tonkotsu in Japan was popular 5-6 years ago, and now it's kind of changed into like this Tokyo style shoyu ramen. And maybe America will follow suit, or the West will follow the same trend lines. But it's going to be really interesting, I think. I think what it's going to be is, I've said in the Discord channel, it's going to be like a lot of these pop-ups coming up. They'll learn, and then they actually like shoyu ramen. They'll serve it at their pop-ups, and that will kind of be the wave that takes it, I think.
Yeah.
So, I think go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah, I think, I mean, if you think about it, like French cuisine, they have consomme, and consomme is clear broth, and people like it, so why not? I've always thought, why not shio shoyu? I never understood why, like, volcano miso ramen, like, stuff like like bowls like that was like overrated in US. I never understood. And there's just so many toppings too. Like I've always hated how Americans people thought that was ramen.
Yeah. What was your first experience when you moved to America and you went to a ramen shop and you ordered a ramen? And what was your first experience like? Now I'm kind of curious because you said you moved when you were 15.
Yeah. But I never had a bowl of ramen until I was like 17, 18. Because there wasn't any in my area.
Oh, okay,
like,
okay.
It was all sushi, frozen yogurt, boba. That was it. And then I found like there was this very first ramen shop in my location. And I was like, okay, like we finally have a ramen shop. That's cool. And I went there with my friend, and then I ordered I ordered a miso, and it came out with like cold canned corn, like a really, really sloppy chashu, like pork butt chashu. What else? Like bamboo shoots, natto, and like soggy noodles, cold broth. And I had it and I was like, I can make much better instant ramen than this bowl.
Yeah. That's the crazy thing is like instant ramen take a lot of times for a lot of these restaurants, instant ramen actually tastes better.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. There's so many things that was missing to the point when I was eating, I forgot that it was ramen. It doesn't feel like ramen at all. But yeah, that's my first impression.
Yeah, that must have been super disappointing.
It really was.
Growing up in Japan and coming here and eating that. Yeah, I see the same thing when Japanese people come to Hawaii, and at McDonald's in Hawaii, they sell saimin, which is like the Hawaii ramen kind of thing.
Oh, really?
And they'll go and like, oh, wow, you can get this. And they'll order it because they see people eating it. And then they can see it on their faces. They take the first bite and like, this sucks. It's so terrible. Because, I mean, first of all, it's from McDonald's. So it's not like it's going to be great anyway, you know?
Right. Do they have an every McDonald's in Hawaii?
Every McDonald's in Hawaii sells salmon.
Oh, really? I never knew.
Every McDonald's in Hawaii also sells spam for breakfast.
Yeah, with rice, right?
Yeah, spam and rice for breakfast.
Yeah, I had that. I went to Hawaii last December.
Oh,
I
had cool. It.
But I don't think I ever saw that Hawaiian ramen on the menu.
Yeah,
I was just not paying attention to it.
Yeah.
I never knew.
Actually, I haven't tried to order it in a while, but when I was growing up, you could get it everywhere, every single McDonald's. But they've kind of changed McDonald's to like that McCafe now. I'm not sure if they still have it, but it was like when I was, that's a good question. I should go and check. I haven't eaten McDonald's in a while, so maybe I'll go check if it's still there.
I'll look it up later.
Yeah. So you started to make your own noodles at home too, if you can go back to the making ramen things. That for making noodles, you kind of have to measure, right? To get it right. Or do you not measure?
Yes, that's one thing. No, that's one thing I measure.
Yeah. I think Hung said it. He didn't measure his first batch of noodles. And so.
Yeah. He told me that too.
Yeah. So you can't really expect it to turn out great if you don't measure. Are you making new batches of noodles for every single new bowl of ramen or new batch of ramen that you're making to match the noodles to the soup? Or do you just have like one general purpose noodle that you do, or what's your approach to that?
I do make noodles. I do match the noodles and the type of broth or ramen I'm making, but like it's either soup comes first or noodle comes first. Like today I knew I have like a batch of noodles frozen in my freezer, and I have like a skimming style thick noodle, like straight 35% hydration noodles in my freezer. And I was like, and then I felt like, and I saw clam chicken like chintan in my freezer too, so I was like, okay, I'm gonna go with the thin noodles. And then when it comes to like noodle making, because whenever I eat my own noodle, I only eat it on the weekends when I work. And during family meal, that's when I cook it, because I don't really have time to cook it at home. So then I just think what I want to eat over the weekend. And whenever I feel like EAK style, I try to make like the noodle that goes with the EAK. If I want something really clean, I try to make thin noodles.
Yeah. And so you kind of just have like a bunch on hand too in the freezer.
Yeah.
That's a good approach. Do you freeze it like in a box? Like I've been freezing it in bags, and then I'd kind of I don't know why it never dawned on me that you could use like a Tupperware container to freeze the noodles and then you won't, it won't break if something hits them and stuff. I was like, oh my God, I'm an idiot. But
for the broth, I use container, like to-go containers. But for noodles, I use Ziploc bags.
Yeah, that's what I'd use too. And then, but if something hits it in the freezer, the noodles break.
Oh, okay.
And so you end up with a bag of broken noodles sometimes. And so,
okay, I see, I see.
Yeah, I've seen some people using like Tupperware containers and then freezing that. And it kind of like protects the noodles. So I was like, oh, that's pretty smart.
Clever.
Yeah.
That's clever.
Yeah, yeah, man. What do you have like, when you do your ramen cooks, are you making like everything specifically for that? Like, so, or do you have like, I guess you could have everything kind of pre-made. Like, do you try to like match everything? So like, you know, like the five components of ramen where you have like the soup, noodles, toppings, oil, everything. And then, are you making like a new aroma oil every time you're making a new soup, or are you, reusing one that you had before, or?
I usually reuse one, reuse the one I have, unless, let's just say if I want to do like a AP miso, like shrimp miso ramen, I do make like new shrimp oil for it. If I want like clam oil for my clam based ramen, I do make scallop oil, clam oil. But like usually all I use is like nigi oil, like aroma oil.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's either that or the truffle oil. It's like one of the easiest.
What do you do for truffle oil? Like, how do you make that?
I do like a half and half ratio of the store-bought truffle oil and a little bit of nigi oil, and that's pretty much it.
Oh, that's pretty smart. And for your nigi oil, are you doing like just canola oil or something, or are you using like chicken fat?
Soybean oil. Soybean oil, nigi, onions, garlic. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
I would use chicken fat if I do have a lot of chicken fat left over from something. I don't like buying extra ingredients. I always like to use like leftovers, or like, let's just say you made a tonkotsu and then next day you have a bunch of lard on top of the soup, and I use that. I take the lard off and then make like a mayo out of it.
It's smart. It's really smart. Yeah, yeah, man. It's good stuff. All righty. Let's go into some listener questions. We kind of got a lot of them. We got a lot from one person. I think you know who it is. So what generally happens for this is when we do put out the questions for the interviews and then people retweet it, we get a lot of the regulars, you know, like people that always listen to the podcast ask questions. But also, if the people that I don't know who they are, there's a 50-50 chance it's going to be troll questions. So I'm just giving you the heads up, because it happens a lot on the show, because I don't know what a troll question is and what's not a troll question. So let's just, okay. So we kind of talked about this. It's kind of a good leading question from, so Ramen Addict Hung was asking, what is your technique for making noodles, and how do you develop your own noodle recipes?
Technique, huh? So like when I first started, the first recipe I did was just like regular bread flour with water and wrong amount of kansui and wrong amount of salt. So I added like nearly 5 times more of kansui than I was supposed to.
Oh, wow.
And I repeated that for like so many times. And then, and like, let's just say like I made 10 batches, 10 test trials, and out of 10, 8 times came out broken. And I've always wondered why this is happening. And then I texted my friend in CI and I was like, hey, what's happening? And he's like, maybe it's your kneading. And like kneading develops the gluten so much. And then I was like, okay, I'll try not to over knead. But then, and it just so kept on happening. So I was like, why is this happening? And then I searched up like basic ramen noodle making techniques, and then kansui was only supposed to be like 1% or like 1.5% of the rate, like the recipe. And I was like, oh, okay, it's a kansui that's boosting the gluten way too much. Uh-huh. And then that led to even like the hydration was up to like 50%. It kept on breaking. And I was like, there's no way like the water hydration is wrong. But then it turned out that it was kansui. So I started like lowering the amount of kansui, and then it turned out well. Then that regular like standard bread flour noodle came out good. I started adding because that time I think I was doing something clean, like Chinatown style. So I wanted more like weedy, like aromatic aroma to the noodles. So I started adding wheat flour, the whole wheat flour. But yeah, then yeah. the first, because I never, like I said, I never do research. So like the first whole wheat noodle I made, I did like 50% broth flour, 50% whole wheat. So it came out like soba noodles almost. It came out brown. Yeah, I was like, okay, that's not cool. So I started like, you know, reducing the amount, replacing the other half of the whole wheat with like breath flour. And then it turned out okay. But then I was like, I want more chewiness to it. So I followed the same recipe, but replaced a few with some of the ratio with tapioca flour. Mm. And then I was like, I want more structure. And I just repeat, it's just like arrange, repeat, make it, taste it. And when it comes to kneading, I stopped over kneading. If that answers Hung's question, I stopped over kneading, but like not to the point. Like you gotta knead somehow so that every like little how do you say when you mix in the water, it creates this little ball looking like shape on the inside of noodles, like the baby noodles. So like, you gotta do that, but like if you over knead it, you're gonna break it. So I usually put into the Ziploc, rest it, and I usually step it with my feet so that it comes out like nice and smooth. But like I used to do that process like 5-6 times back then.
So like folding over the dough and stepping out it again. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I noticed that it's just drying the noodles.
Oh, I see.
And breaking the gluten, yeah.
Yeah, usually I do that too. I do the exact same thing. Like I do the loose dough, rest it there, and then just step on it once to flatten it down. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I just cut it, like start rolling it down and cutting it into noodles. Yeah, that's what I've been trying to do too recently.
Mm, that's cool.
Yeah.
Hope that answered Hung's question.
yeah, he just started making noodles after all this time. So it's cool. Yeah, it's kind of like because of the lockdowns, I guess he kind of has to now. Yeah, so.
Yeah, you got to measure. Tell him to measure.
Yeah, you got to measure, man. Do you like just generally like 1% for kansui, or do you do
1.5? Yeah, 1.5, yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I found too. And salt, just 1% too. That's
1%.
Yeah. Cool, man. All right. So this one is one of the ones that I've never seen this name before. So it could be a trolley question. So Balcony Beanie Bag asks, what are your thoughts on extruded ramen noodles compared to rolled and cut?
What does he mean?
There's some machines that, Japanese machines I've seen that you just put the dough in.
Like the one, and then it just comes out like.
Yeah, like the Play-Doh Factory. Okay. You know, you get the Play-Doh thing and you smash the Play-Doh and it comes out in the hair and stuff.
From by Philips, right?
It's by Philips.
Okay. If it works, it's okay, I guess. I never used it before, so I don't know. Uh-huh. But like in the, in Kanda-san's Facebook ramen group, I see people having that, and then I see like people making noodles with that machine, and it turns out, by the picture, it looks really good.
Mm. I wonder if you have to do like pretty high hydration for that, because
I think so.
I can't imagine like a low hydration dough getting smashed that easily.
You're just gonna break the dough inside the machine before.
Yeah, or just break the machine. Out, yeah.
I don't think you can mass produce with that too.
Yeah, probably not. Like I've seen Japanese YouTubers use that, you know, like you know how Japanese YouTubers are, they make videos every single day. So like they'll do like whatever.
You try to follow the trend and whatever.
Yeah. They'll do like their half-ass attempt at making noodles.
It's fun to watch though.
Yeah. Cool, man. All right. So JNM Stewart asks, what's the best ramen you've had outside of Japan?
Outside of Japan. I was going to say Nakamura in New York. When I first went there, I had the Yuzushio ramen. And Nakamura is, his brother is the owner of Afuri.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So when I first had their Yuzushio ramen, it was really, really good. And I was like, okay, wow. And that was, I had it when I started making ramen too. Mm-hmm. So it was like huge impact on me. But when I went there the second time, it didn't taste the same. Yeah,
I've had similar experiences to that too. Like where there's a restaurant in Hawaii called Alan Wong's. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like a really famous chef in Hawaii. And that was the first meal I ever ate where I went to a restaurant and I was like, my mind was just blown. Like, I've never, and I was like an adult already. I was like 20 something, young adult, maybe like around your age, right out of college. And I went there and I ordered this fish thing. And I was like in a bad mood when I went because I didn't want to go. And then, but my wife brought, she's my girlfriend at the time, but my wife brought me to hang out with her friends. And I remember eating it and like just my whole attitude changed by eating that thing. And so like that was my first experience of food being able to do that, like tasting food that tasted that good. So I kind of like interesting. So I'm sorry I got off that tangent because your story kind of reminded me of that experience. That probably made it might have been similar for you.
Yeah, it's it does happen all the time.
Yeah.
The like second visit to that Nakamura was it was opposite for me. It made me grumpy. It didn't enlighten my feeling because I expected the like a good bowl of ramen like I had before, and I went there and it was just like the broth was it smelled like it's obvious that that person who made the broth didn't wash the bones well. It was warm, not hot. It wasn't hot. It was just like weird because I knew how good it's supposed to taste like.
Yeah. That was like the exact same thing happened. I went back and it didn't taste the same. Like, I don't know if it's kind of just like you do like drugs and you can never catch the same high or something. Yeah, I don't know if it's that or if it's like the food actually was worse. I'm not sure which one it was, but yeah. So that's still like the best one in your mind, that first Nakamura.
The first bowl in Nakamura was the best.
What do you
guarantee?
You can't guarantee the results. Yeah. What do you think about the idea of putting like acid into ramen? Because you know you said it's a yuzu shoyu. Yuzu is like in the citrus family. It has a little bit of acid. So what are your thoughts on that? Because I know like some people like Mike says it's not something that's traditionally added into ramen, into tares or into soups or anything.
There's this, I forgot where in Japan, but it's this regional ramen. It's called Sudachi ramen. Sudachi is like Japanese lime. Like I think that's the closest citrus family fruit to Sudachi. So it's like really, really clean, light shoyu ramen and then nicely folded noodles. And there's like lime wheels. That bowl is topped with lime wheels and that exists. And that tastes good. It's a really, really acidic, refreshing bowl of ramen in Japan. So I don't have anything. I'm not against adding citrus at all.
Yeah. Cool. All right. This is from Chill Gong Fu. And autocorrect messed up his question. So I'm going to guess what he wrote. It says, have you ever used wild animal bones for a broth? If yes, then which animal and what kind of broth?
No, I don't. No, not that I can. No, I never.
Yeah.
Nope.
It must be
wild animal meaning like rabbits,
or just like a wild boar, or like a wild deer, or.
I've had it before, but not on my. I never cooked it.
Oh really? Like how have you had like wild boar ramen or something?
No. Oh no, not ramen, but like as a dish.
Oh, I see.
As a meat, I had rabbit before. Not a huge fan. Nah, it was nasty.
Okay, cool. Let's see. Nama Japan TV asks, is there a way to bring Burmese flavor into ramen? And what would that look like?
Yes, definitely. I say, so there's this traditional Burmese fish soup dish called mohenga. It's really similar to the Thai soup, tom yum soup. The only difference is that tom yum, they use like chilies and lemongrass. Chilies and lemongrass. And for Burma, for mohenga, they use lemongrass and white fish, like tilapia, stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
So it's like tilapia, smashed tilapia with onion, garlic, lemongrass, pepper, nampla, fish sauce. And then you make a soup out of it. And it's really, really, really good. And then like that just like reminds me of gyokai style, like miso almost.
Oh, wow.
It gives the fishy flavor, aroma. And then Burmese food are known for having like a lot of oil in it. And I see some similarity to Burmese, like oily Burmese food with Japanese, like oily, heavy, like like noko tonkotsu ramen. Mm-hmm. The level of oil is almost the same. And like,
is it emulsified also, like that too? Like noko tonkotsu ramen is kind of like that emulsified. It is. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
And also, Burmese food is really interesting because in north of Burma is China, mm-hmm. to the west is India, and to the east is Thailand. So like Burmese food is originally like a fusion of all those four.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Burmese food with China, Burmese food with India, Burmese food with Thai. So like if you go north, you can eat something similar to like maza soba or stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
And if you go to Thai too, like you can eat stuff like maza soba with like more acid kind of style. And then if you go to west, you have more curry.
Oh, wow.
And then like when first that whole maza soba, abura soba trend started in Japan, like past like 4 years ago, I guess.
Yeah.
That's when I started seeing a lot of them. My dad was like, this is Burmese food. This is Burmese food.
That's cool, yeah. Man. So Burmese food, what would that look like? It would look like maza soba.
Maza soba with like coconut oil, maybe something like that. That's what my dad made the other day. He made a chicken curry. So it was thick noodle, like thick egg noodles, like Chinese egg noodles with curry chicken, with coconut oil, shallots, cilantro. And he used my shiotada to do the flavor adjustments. And some nampla, soy, fish sauce. To it, and like it looks Burmese because he made it, but like let's just say if like a random Japanese ramen chef made that in their kitchen, I say
that's
fusion, like exotic, like Southeastern Asian style maza soba, like
yeah it's crazy how much the what the dish looks like can depend upon who's the person that puts it in front of you, you know. Yeah, because there's like I've seen there's a ramen shop. Like, I haven't gone to Japan in such a long time, and I've never eaten too much ramen in Japan, but people send me these videos to, like, translate for them and stuff, and there's a ramen shop called Mandiki, and it's, like, an Indian super heavy spiced ramen, and it's, like, if an Indian dude put that in front of you, you'd be, like, oh, this is, like, Indian food, but it's a Japanese guy that's making it, so it's, like, you know, this ramen.
Something like kare udon and everything. Kare udon is such a normal thing for us now, but like if you think about it, it's just so weird.
Yeah.
Some Indian food with traditional Japanese noodle soup.
Yeah, man. That's kind of funny. I never thought about that. Yeah. Like what the person who puts it in front of you looks like is gonna change your opinion also. Huh.
It really does.
So this is from I don't know if autocorrect. Umo Keichan. Umo?
I think I know. Yeah.
Okay. What inspired you to become a chef? I guess you kind of talked about that earlier, but if you have any.
No, I actually had. Okay. I'll talk about what made me start cooking.
Yeah.
So like I said, I moved to US when I was 15. Mm-hmm. And back then, like, even though my parents are cooks, like I never cooked in my life before. But then, so when I moved here, and there was like absolute no good Japanese restaurants in my area, so like I had to, whenever I crave for like real Japanese food, I was like, hey mom, can you make this weekend, stuff like that. But then she got busy with work, so I couldn't ask for a favor every single time. And I was like, maybe I gotta, and in my mind I had this thought of myself starting to like learn how to cook and everything. And then, but like I never actually took an action for that. But back then, I was a sophomore in high school. Back then, I was really into this idol group called AKB48.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a huge fan of them. And then they had this show on TV show where they called this celebrity chef. He was trending back then, and those idol girls were like going crazy for him because apparently he was cute, which I never thought he was cute. But then I was like, okay, if this guy can do it, I can do it.
Yeah. Japanese, Japanese cute guys doesn't really translate outside of Japan sometimes. So
yeah. Especially the kids like those idol girls, I was really I really like, they were they looked obsessed, and you know, they were like going crazy for that guy. So I guess I got a little jealous. And I was like, if he can cook, I can cook too. And that's how I started cooking. And then I graduated CIA. So
stuff
can happen.
That's basically like Kanda-san's story as well.
Yeah.
He's like jealous of a girl. And the girl was jealous. He was jealous that the girl's complimenting that other ramen chef so much.
Yeah,
like, I can do that too. Yeah, man. Good stuff. Okay, let's go. This is from Evening Blue. This is like 6 questions. So you probably know who this person is. Yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna skip some because you answered some of them already.
Okay.
So how long does the process of making ramen usually take for you?
To make ramen or like from start to eating?
From start to eating, I guess.
Start to eating. Okay. Well, making ramen, so you gotta mix the flour, water. That doesn't take much time. You knead it. You rest. I usually rest it for an hour, depending on what I'm making, but like on average, like an hour. And then I rolled it out. That takes like 15, 20 minutes, depending on how much I'm making. And then I always like to rest it in the fridge for at least 2 days. Mm-hmm. So from making to eating, it takes 2 days.
Oh, wow. And then the soup and stuff you're making. I mean, noodles seem to be like the longest. The thing that takes the most time.
Yeah, because it got to rest.
Right?
It got to rest, yeah.
What is your opinion? Have you ever made noodles without resting? Like, have you ever tried
to? Yeah, I did. It's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay, but then I ate the exact same batch like 3 days after it, and the color changed. It smells more weedy, flour. Uh-huh. Texture is totally different because it just absorbed all the... And it was like kept under this like temperature for exact same temperature for 2 nights, 3 nights. Mm-hmm. And I think the composition of the noodle just changed during those times. And it really is a huge difference. Mm-hmm. I can't really explain how different, why and how it's different, but like I can guarantee it's really different.
Yeah. I found that too. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. I know Mike has gone in Discord and explained it a bunch, but I don't know. To me, it's just you do it. I might try to do some noodles today without resting because I tried to make some last night and it didn't turn out well. Okay. And I got to shoot a video. So
we'll
see how that goes. But
you can eat it. It's still good though.
Yeah, it still works. It's just not going to be as good as if you rested. Right. So.
But like there are a few places in Japan, they make noodles to order.
Oh, wow.
They need it to order. They need it to order. They cut it to order. Mm-hmm. And I forgot. It was part of the ramen museum last year. I can't remember the name of the ramen place, but the doughs get sheeted right in front of you.
Oh,
they have
wow.
this like sheeting machine. It's just rotating. And then when they get the order, they cut that sheet into noodles and then they boil it and they give it to you.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so I guess there's like, that's kind of the thing with ramen.
Preference, I don't know.
Yeah, there's really no hard rules, I guess, because you can just do whatever you want and it's your ramen.
That's just like ramen in general. Like you can add, like I said earlier, if a Japanese guy chooses to put coconut milk curry in it, it's still a ramen.
Yeah, it's just like, that's kind of the thing that's I'm slowly growing to appreciate and understand more is that there's no... Mm-hmm. You can't say it's wrong, like anything is the wrong way to do it because there's general guidelines about like this is proper technique and stuff, but if the flavor that comes out is what the chef actually wanted to put out, then you can't say that it's wrong.
Yeah, it's a ramen then.
Yeah, it's still ramen. All right, man. Let's see. Do you want to open a ramen restaurant someday? Please explain what it would be. Oh, cool. Okay. Yes. So please, what kind of ramen restaurant do you want to open?
I really want to, like my ideal is I want to open like 2 different locations if possible, but like the first one will definitely be something really classic, like Tokyo classic style. And I want to do like 2-3 styles of ramen in each location. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to sell chintan and tonkotsu at one place.
I want
more of that counter seating open kitchen style ramen place.
Do you think that could work in the US as far as like in Japan people get in and out, you know? I interviewed Motoki who runs 5 shops in Japan and he said the average time is like 10 to 15 minutes. Someone will come in, eat, leave. But in America or his shops, he had a shop in Indonesia And he said that those people would come in and 30 minutes and eat and talk and drink and stuff and then leave. Do you think that counter style restaurant could work in America?
Maybe like if you provide like few tables, like four top tables and maybe five of them in a restaurant and a counter, like people who want to hang out, they can sit there. People who are here for like ramen, like eat and go, they can sit at the counter. Cause like how fast, like by like seeing how fast Chipotle rotates.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
It's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a place in LA too that does fresh pasta. They fly in pasta from Italy called, I forget what it's called, Uovo or something like that. And they have a similar concept where they're doing just counter seating and their turnover is real fast. Like people come in, eat, they cook fresh pasta right there. They serve it. The people eat it within 15 minutes and then they're gone. So it's kind of similar. And so if it's working in LA, it might be able to work in other places. I was kind
of
thinking.
Like, I don't know if you ever heard of Ramen Lab in Baisongdo in New York. I went there like last month before this whole corona thing started. I went there with my friend and they had, it was tachigui style. They had no seats. It was just counter and people stand. Yeah. And then I think the seating limit was, well, standing limit was like 10 people.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe like a few more, maybe like 12, 13 people at once. But like people are like lining up to eat the ramen.
That's smart. And just don't put seats. Just
don't put chairs. But like I saw it operating like all right. So it is possible.
Maybe that's a secret maybe that's a secret for every ramen shop in America. Just don't put chairs.
Exactly. Just stand and eat.
Stand and eat. Because people if people can't relax because they're standing up, then they have to finish quicker. Oh, cool, man. All right. Let's go to okay, this is a she had like tons of questions. I'm going to skip to the last one. If someone, because you answered the rest earlier.
Okay.
If someone had never tried ramen, how would you introduce it to them?
Like American person?
Yeah. Let's just say an American person. Like someone who doesn't really have much exposure to Japanese culture, Japanese food. And it's like, oh, you know, how would you show this person? Like, oh, this is ramen.
That's really hard because definition of ramen is like really different depending on a person. This really is a hard question. Hold on. what would you answer?
Yeah, I'm not really sure because there's a couple of hard things with this is that for a lot of people, when you hear the word ramen, they think of instant ramen in America.
Yeah. That's
so
true.
You kind of have to break that first. And how do you, like, maybe that's kind of why tonkotsu is so popular in America is that it's so different it's than so different instant ramen.
Yeah, it's really thick.
Because most instant ramen kind of is like the default, like, Maruchan kind of ramen.
It's
like,
it's technically like a chintan.
Yeah, like a shoyu chintan. Yeah. So
I don't want to just say noodle soup either because that's not what it is. Because I believe ramen is, because people always like fight over what's the main component of ramen. Is it the noodle or is it the soup? Like in my mind, it's just like a like really, really balanced and unique harmony of noodle and soup. That's my definition of ramen in my mind. But like, was that an answer? Unique harmony of noodle and soup. Yeah.
What would you serve that person? Like, you know, so say someone comes to your house, never had ramen before. What would you put down? Like, okay, here, eat this. This is a good example of what ramen is.
It really depends where that person is from. If that person is like American who likes bold flavors, I'll probably give he or her a bowl of tonkotsu with thick noodles, chashu, egg, scallions. That's it. But no pickles, like no nothing crazy though. Something you'll actually see in Japan.
That's a very
But then like, if that person comes from like France, somewhere in Europe, it's just my assumption, but I just think they would like something more cleaner, and I might give them like a shoyu chintan, shio chintan.
That's very those. Like a very Japanese approach to thinking about it, because it's like you're thinking about the person.
And like, Europeans knows the gourmet, so I feel like they should understand some new culture, right?
And the nuances like, of a cleaner broth. You have those hints of things you can taste. The whole
Italian person, I'll give a niboshi to show you. They like anchovies.
Oh yeah. That's actually what I'm working on right now. Is like,
oh yeah,
I'm working on like a I came up, I so we're in lockdown here in Hawaii and I can't go to the grocery store that often. So I'm like, I'm trying to do like a lockdown ramen series with just like making things that I have with ramen with things that I have. And I found anchovy paste in my fridge. And it's like, man, I tried it yesterday. It's like, it actually works. Like you can use it like very similarly to niboshi. It tastes like anchovies, but it's, I mean, it still works. So like, yeah, niboshi ramen would work fine if someone's used to anchovies.
I've done it once. I just simply mixed a few inch of anchovy paste into my shoyu tare and just made like a dirty shoyu.
Yeah, that's what I did.
And it worked. It worked.
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to be like as good as if you get really high quality niboshi or anything, but it's like if you're on lockdown and you want like that
lazy, lazy niboshi shoyu.
Yeah. For real, man. Yeah. Cool. All right. Yeah, like that's what Kanda-san was talking about. He's like, the most important thing is you're thinking about what kind of ramen that person that you're serving it to wants to eat, or what would be the best thing I could make for them. And so when you're answering, it's like, man, this guy is like, you're Japanese. You have that Japanese way of thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, like there's other people out there that'll be just be like, no, you know, just serve whatever you want to eat, you know? And then if you spend, which is also true, you know, like I've heard Mike say this, that if you spend a lot of time on your craft and you're diligent in choosing ingredients and you're trying to make the best thing that tastes the best to you, it's going to be hard to serve it to somebody and they're going to be like, oh, I don't like this, if you're putting that much effort into something. But there's, I guess those are the two approaches you can take it. Like, you know, you're trying to make something that tastes the best to your taste palate, to your palate, and then serving that as an expression of yourself. And then
when it comes to a restaurant, when it comes to business, you have to think of customers first, like what they like. I'm a Tokyo shoyu, like classic Tokyo style ramen person, but at the place at Chaplin's where I work, the number one bowl of ramen customers eat is a few, it's a tom yum tonkotsu ramen. That's the number one, and honestly I'm not a, I mean, it's good, but like since I'm a ramen nerd, I'm not a huge fan because it's just like a cheat sheet for me, you know, like all the flavor is totally relied on the red curry paste from Thailand. But that's what customers like, so you just gotta let it go.
Yeah, man, like it's that's the challenge, I guess, for running a restaurant in America is that creating things that people like. And like in business, like I have like kind of like a business background too, where it's just like the market kind of decides what's right. And that's kind of like hard for a lot of, like I've run like this website with my friends where we teach people how to play the ukulele for like the last 12 years. And like the market decides, like we want to teach the proper technique and, you know, like these music theory and all these things. And then the market decides that they want to learn how to strum with their thumb, you know, like that kind of stuff. It's kind of like that. Like it's the challenge of balancing that. Like you don't want to compromise your morals, but at the same time, you got to balance that with understanding that people want to eat a certain type of thing. So it's probably the biggest challenge for anybody in America.
It's really tough.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the next question. So this is, I am, oh gosh, Muzungu. With miso ramen, is it best to mix different types of miso, or can you just use one type?
I like mixing. When I make miso tare, I use two different miso, just like simple akamiso and shiro miso with spices, oil, like those stuff. But it's hard because like when I think of miso ramen, it's a little thick broth. Since it's miso, miso already has like flour and structure to it. It's already, miso already is like layered with flavor. So I never expect something light from when I hear miso ramen. So I expect something really heavy, like layered with flavors. So to meet that definition of miso ramen in my mind, I do layer the miso tare with flavor. But like I never, but like, it's weird because like miso ramen is usually it comes out thick, but I don't, I think majority of the places in Japan where they serve miso ramen, I don't think they ever use tonkotsu or paitan at all. I think most of the places use jintan, like buta chintan or tori chintan.
Yeah, yeah, that's what Mike was saying.
Yeah, oh yeah, he was saying, okay.
Yeah.
right. Cool. Oh yeah, I think it's always a good thing to layer miso or other spices with when you're making miso tare or miso ramen.
Cool.
Definitely. Cool. It's interesting. It's really interesting.
Yeah, miso is one of those things where you kind of, like Brian said it on his episode, can it be really good or really bad depending on your execution?
Because like miso itself, because like if you fail on a miso ramen, that means you don't know ramen. For me, like that just like defines that person, but like that person doesn't know ramen because miso itself already tastes good. Yeah, how can it fail?
Yeah, like, the worst it should taste like is miso soup, which is still not bad, you know? But if you make something that doesn't taste good at all, it's like, oh, pretty talented.
Yeah. So most of the miso ramen I had in America was just miso soup.
Yeah, with noodles in it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to this. A couple more questions here. Durbastiman asks if you have any secret or unusual tare ingredients that you use.
Unusual ingredients for tare, right? Mm-hmm. For curry, I have tons of secret ingredients.
You guys like the kaigun curry kind of thing, where you like
No, like whenever I make curry, I like grinding the spices. I start from there.
Oh wow!
I roast the spices to make a curry powder first, and then in my curry powder, at least there's 7 different spices. Sometimes it goes up to 15.
Especially
because it's really unique. Because like I said, I have a Burmese background and Burmese has Indian background. So I grew up eating curry as well. So like our kitchen is packed with spices. So I always have I always have access to different kinds of spices. And yeah, I make the curry powder first, but then I make a roux as well with flour and butter. That's some French cooking method right there. Yeah. And I mix the curry powder into the roux and I make a curry roux like those the ones you can get in Japanese grocery stores.
Yeah.
And then I use my leftover tori chintan or pai tan or tonkotsu, whatever I have in the freezer, and then make a curry paste, curry sauce. And I put coffee in there.
I put chocolate
in there. Sometimes I put vanilla ice cream in there. Like,
I've seen that before. I didn't know how it comes out. I've never tried it yet.
It's really normal. Like, it comes out pretty good. Like, it comes out just like a normal good curry dish, more than you expect.
Oh, can't really try this.
It only gives like a milky, consistent like velocity to the curry, and the coffee only brings the coffee just like expands the depth of the flavor, and chocolate just gives the color and a little nuttiness. So if you think about it, it's really
I guess so. It's because it's just really like cream and sugar and eggs, so
yeah,
makes sense.
Do you make chocolate ramen?
Oh
yeah, that was good too. It actually was good.
Do you do like curry ramen a lot?
Curry ramen, no, that's one thing I never done. I make a lot of curry udon, but I never make curry ramen.
Oh.
I don't think I ever had curry ramen unless the cup noodle curry flavor.
Yeah. All right. The next question is from Andre Key. He says, How do you plate your what is he saying? How do you plate your ramen? Damn, bro, you're doing something.
That's what he said.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he's just asking, like, what do you have any tips for plating?
Right. I mean, I think he's the person who was on this podcast.
Yeah, he's been on the podcast.
Okay. Yeah, I saw his Instagram page the other day. Like, I think it was yesterday. And I was looking at his pictures and I was like, bro, what are you doing to your bowl? You're doing something.
Yeah. Do you have any, like, tips as far as, like, what do you put down first usually?
Tare.
Oh, no, I mean, as far as like so you have the bowl, you have the noodles in. There. Yeah, so like you're starting to put your toppings on. Like, what's the first topping that goes down?
If I'm doing like a jiroke style, of course you put the vegetable first, but like something that goes on the bottom first. But what I always keep in my mind is I want that like mountain, like nice layers of toppings. So whatever that gives up the height to the bowl, that comes first. Let's just say if I'm doing a, let's just say I'm using shiranegi, the scallion grass, chashu, and egg. I would put chashu first, mm-hmm. and then eggs on the other side. And I usually make like a parallel. I always try to make a parallel line on my bowl so that it looks balanced. Mm-hmm. Unless I have like four different toppings and it's a different story. But I always, if I have like only like two or three toppings, I try to line it up so that it looks nice and clean and organized.
Oh, I see. Do you start in the middle first? Do you chashu in the middle, or do chashu facing the customer or facing the person eating it?
Yeah, facing the customer. So I put like two layers of chashu first, mm-hmm. and then egg on the other side, and then scallion in the middle. Mm. And I like my scallion overlapping the chashu, because it doesn't make sense if chashu is like overlapping a scallion. Just smash the scallion, and then it doesn't give any height. Mm-hmm. I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, I think so. I think if someone listens to this and then checks out your Instagram, they'll see mm-hmm. what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Do you make, so this is from Confucius Eats. Do you make or do you buy your kansui for noodles?
I've been buying kansui.
The Japanese one, or is it just like the Amazon one? Oh, okay.
The Japanese one. Because the thing about me, I'm really lucky. I work at a restaurant. I'm a sous chef there. So mm-hmm. I have access to produce companies.
Oh, okay.
So whenever I do like an inventory for the restaurant, I was like, okay, I'm out of this at home. I'll take a little bit. I take a little bit.
You're going to use it at the restaurant anyway.
Yeah. If you order like 5 gallons of soy sauce, if you take 2 cups, that's nothing. That's not much of a loss for the restaurant.
How important is it for like for soy sauce and stuff? Are you guys getting like the super high quality stuff at the restaurant? Or are you
no,
getting,
just
like,
Kikkoman.
Oh, just like regular. Just the regular stuff. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The Japanese kansui, I've never tried it yet, but I've kind of read what's in it. So I always try to like recreate it with what I can get, like potassium carbonate and sodium carbonate. But
yeah. I've always wanted to try those kansui water, the Chinese kansui water.
Yeah.
I always see it at the grocery stores, but like, I just don't know. I don't know the level, the pH level.
That's the biggest challenge is you don't know how much pH. Know. So, I mean, there's a way to calculate it if you have like that Balmy scale and stuff, but it's,
you gotta
buy another thing and it's like not really worth it. But yeah, I know a lot of people that use it. I think Andre uses it too.
Oh, really? Does it?
Yeah.
I guess it works, right? He makes a lot of noodle soup.
Yeah. His noodle recipe, he sent it to me. It's really complicated. It's a lot of stuff in there.
Okay.
Cool, man. So that was kind of like, he had one more question, but you answered it already. So that's pretty much all the listener questions we got. I guess we can kind of wrap up. My son actually has a distance learning class meeting in a couple minutes.
Of course.
Could you tell everybody where they can find you on Instagram, or if you're cooking at someplace, your restaurant, or if you're probably closed down now because of lockdown, but
no, we're open.
Oh, your ears are open. Okay.
We're open for takeout. And yesterday was my first day off since the whole Corona thing started.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So, you can find me on Instagram. My account name is Payson, just my name, PayeSone. Search it up. I'm there. And if you want to come see me, I guess I'm in DC. This chap, ramen restaurant called Chaplains, and just tell the server, I don't know, whoever, hey, let me meet this guy. I'll come up like anytime.
Maybe come out and visit after coronavirus is done.
Yeah, please.
Someone comes like coughing, like, hey, can get your piss on? Coughing everywhere. It's like,
just when I go 86 and I'll go.
Just wait until the coronavirus thing passes and then come and visit the restaurant Chaplains. Cool, man. All right. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. All right. Hopefully see you soon.
Yeah.
Talk to you soon. Yeah.
Thanks so much again to Payson for coming on the show. It was really fun for me to listen to his approach to making ramen. And I think his advice of choosing your main flavor and making sure that you don't overpower that with aromatics or other things is a really great point. also his thought process when it comes to trying to make ramen that you feel like the person you're serving is gonna like, I thought was really reminiscent of Kanda-san from the last episode, so I thought that was pretty cool. I'm kind of curious of what you guys think about that topic. Do you feel it's more important to try to create something that the guest will enjoy, like you're thinking about what kind of ramen that their taste might lean towards, or do you think it's more important to serve a bowl of ramen that really is an expression of yourself? I know they aren't mutually exclusive things, but I'm just kind of wondering what you guys feel and what's your gut instinct on that. Please follow Peison on Instagram. He's one of the lucky ones where his name is his username, so it's at Peison, at P-A-Y-E-S-O-N-E. He's putting up some great looking bowls there, so just give him a follow, check it out. You can also follow me on Instagram at Way of Ramen, and please give me any suggestions for who you'd like to see on the show. You know, it's kind of freeing up now. Everybody's on lockdown. Maybe I'll be able to get some people that I haven't been able to get on yet. So thank you guys all so much for listening. I hope you're all staying safe and healthy, and I'll see you all in the next episode.